were gathering to kill him. The letter was carried by a messenger who entered Kufa in the dark by climbing over the city walls. The messenger reached Habib's house. As Habib, his wife, and his young son were sitting down for breakfast, Habib read the letter, kissed it, and tears began to flow down his cheeks. His wife asked him what was wrong. Habib said, "Who would ever have thought that people would be so thirsty for the blood of the grandson of the Holy Prophet, whose name they're uttering every adhan and in every salah?" At Asr, in the evening, when most people were in the mosque, Habib slipped out of Kufa. He mounted his horse and galloped towards Karbala. Habib ibn Zahir reached Karbala late in the evening. Imam Hussein greeted Habib with great affection. On the fateful day of Ashura, between Zuhr and Asr, Habib ibn Zahir rode into the battlefield. He fought bravely. Finally, he was overpowered. He fell to ground. Imam Hussein rushed to him. Habib looked at Imam and said, "O the grandson of the Holy Prophet, please forgive this humble servant for not being able to give more than his unworthy life for you and Islam." The Imam took Habib in his arms and cried, "O my friend, O my friend." Habib was killed, resting his head on Imam's shoulder. Dear brothers and sisters, accept our sorrow and condolences on the month of Muharram. I invite you to listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with certain aspects of the life and times of Habib ibn Muzahir al-Asadi, who was one of the Ashura martyrs in Karbala. Habib was such a devout person, and he was very much a very pious person. On the authority of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Habib ibn Muzahir al-Asadi recited the whole Quran overnightly. Every night and overnightly. Regarding his religious piety, it must be indicated that Habib ibn Muzahir was a very pious person, and he wasn't devoted to this worldly life. Rather, he reminded himself and others of the life of the eternal life in the world hereafter. And it must be indicated and asserted that Habib ibn Muzahir, he was such a personality that when a Muslim Aqil migrated at the command and order of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam from Mecca to Al-Kufa, Habib ibn Muzahir got associated with Muslim Aqil because Muslim Aqil represented Imam al-Husayn al-Salam. And when the city of Al-Kufa and its suburbs were all surrounded by the agents of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, so that nobody would be able to escape Al-Kufa in order to join Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Habib ibn Muzahir preferred to take rest in daytime and in the evening and in midnight, he made his way in order to escape the guarding soldiers around the city of Al-Kufa and its suburbs. And then he joined Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the seventh day of Muharram. He joined Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the seventh day of Muharram, and for doing so, he received the warm appreciation of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And then, since Habib ibn Muzahir was a man who belonged to Banu Asad, the Asad tribe, Arab tribe, he suggested Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he suggested Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to go there and to bring more forces for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Well, he went there and he talked with his own his own people over there. They wanted to come to help Imam al-Husayn as salam. However, the agents of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad reported that Habib ibn Muzahir was collecting forces, was recruiting more forces for Imam al-Husayn as salam. And because of this, and in order not to get entangled over there, without having doing anything, to be entangled and to be arrested by the security forces of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, Umar ibn Habib ibn Muzahir preferred to escape the situation and to join Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam anew. And he did this.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
On the day of Ashura, first of all, his horse was hamstrung, and then after that, when Habib al-Muzahir was dismounted, he continued fighting the Umayyad forces. And one of the Umayyad soldiers over there, by the name of Budayl ibn Maryam, beheaded Habib al-Muzahir al-Asadi, and he was martyred in that way. And then when he was martyred over there, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam went to him and appreciated his braveness, his bravery, his contribution, and his crucial role on the day of Ashura. Regarding attitude of Habib ibn Muzahir to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, it's very noteworthy that on the eve of Ashura, when Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam collected all his male companions in a very large tent and delivered his speech for his staunch companions over there, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated and asserted that he never expected anybody to remain with him, because on the ensuing day, that is on the day of Ashura, everybody on his side, that is in his camp, would certainly be martyred. And then one by one, the companions of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam started expressing their attitudes to him, to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Among them, Habib ibn Muzahir al-Asadi was one of those people who stood up, and because he was an old companion of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he stood up and delivered a short talk in support of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and indicated that if he would be martyred for 1,000 times, yet he was still very much zealous to remain on the side of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And this is a good indication of his devotion to the camp of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Tasu'a, the day of loyalty and resistance. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and welcome to the program. Heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the poignant occasion of Tasu'a, or the ninth of the morning month of Muharram, the day preceding history's most heartrending tragedy. It is the anniversary of the day which continues to jolt human conscience, as the conscientious concentrate on what transpired in Karbala in the year 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD, when Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sought a day's respite from the enemy forces surrounding him and demanding pledge of allegiance from him to the godless rule of the tyrant Yazid. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, didn't seek a day's respite to contemplate on how to avoid death, but yearning for martyrdom in the way of God, he gave a day's respite to the Umayyad forces to think of the evil in which they were trapped and the consequences of their wicked actions. In this way, he left a lasting legacy for all free thinkers of all generations, including of our own times, when the world is facing modern-day tyrants, to take stock of the situation for defeating the plots of the devils in human form in the best possible way. True, the Imam said that he and his companions wanted to spend the day and the night in prayers and supplications in the divine court before embarking for the other world, but in the process, the Imam gave humanity all respite to contemplate in every age and place on the magnitude of the oppression of the Yazid and his likes, in order to strive more resolutely for justice and virtue for reforming societies. Stay with us for a special feature on this day, which is associated in Iran and Iraq with the valiant standard bearer of Karbala, Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon him, who bravely courted martyrdom on the day of Ashura while trying to bring water to the thirsty encampment of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, but making sure that not a drop would touch his own parched lips, since the children in the camp were thirsty. Incidentally, today, because of a day's difference in sighting of a crescent, is the 8th of Muharram in the subcontinent, a day on which the commemorative ceremonies for Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him, are traditionally held. On the afternoon of this day in 61 AH, with the arrival of the godless Shemr Zeljoshan in Karbala, with a letter from Yazid's tyrannical governor of Kufa, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, to tighten the siege around Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and attack him, the ungodly Umayyad hordes, led by their commander, Umar ibn Sa'd, advanced on the small encampment of the Prophet's grandson. The savage enemy started mobilizing its forces on the plain of Karbala, and suddenly the voice of Umar ibn Sa'd, the commander of Yazid's army, was heard ordering attack on the encampment of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The horrific sound of the enemy's horses frightened the women and the children. Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, rushed towards her brother. Abu Mekhnaf, in his famous Maqtal, or account of martyrdom, has written that Imam Hussein was sitting with his head on his knees when Zainab informed him of the enemy's approaches. The Imam, saying, "May God bless you, my sister, calm down," turned to his loyal brother Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him, and said, "Brother, may my life be sacrificed for you. Go to the enemy and seek the reason of their advance upon us." Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him, went to the enemy and realized that they were coming either to forcibly take oath of allegiance from the Imam for the illegal rule of the tyrant Yazid, or, in the case of refusal, to kill the Prophet's grandson. He informed the Imam of the situation and the enemy's plan. The Imam told Abbas to return to them and do whatever he can for postponing their attack to the morning of the next day, so that he can spend the time in prayer and supplications. Thus, the night of Ashura became one of the unforgettable nights of history. Imam Hussein's option for respite on this night was a master stroke of spirituality to revive Islam and show to the posterity, for all generations to come, the firm faith and trust in God of those who are resolute and sure of their ethereal objectives. The Imam drew the line between truth and falsehood. He showed that although the hordes of Yazid that were assembled on the field of Karbala claimed to be Muslim, performed prayers, read the Noble Quran, and fasted, they were nothing more than hypocrites, a misled lot unable to differentiate between good and evil, and incapable of understanding the concept of justice or the principles of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Moreover, they were worse than beasts for their inability to recognize the real Imam of the age and the true meanings of the message of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, who had bequeathed to Muslims the Noble Quran and adherence to his Ahlul Bayt as the two preciously weighty things that could save them from going astray. The night of Ashura was the last night of association of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his household. It is said that the Imam and his companions prayed in such a way that it seemed bees were buzzing around the honeycomb. On this night, the Imam called all his companions, extinguished the lamps, and after thanking them for their loyalty, told them that they were free to leave because the enemy only wanted him and not the life of others. The companions in turn reaffirmed their pledge of loyalty and told him life was worthless without him, the real divinely decreed leader. Among the glorious sins of the night of Ashura was the statement of Qasim, the son of the Imam's elder brother, Imam Hassan, peace upon him. Qasim, who had just entered teens, enthusiastically asked his uncle, "Is my name in the list of martyrs?" Imam Hussein, peace upon him, replied, "My son, what do you think about death?" He said, "Oh, my uncle, I believe that death is sweeter than honey." The Imam, with tearful eyes, said, "Yes, You will be martyred, and so will your infant cousin, my six-month-son, Ali Asghar. At this, Qasim asked, will the enemy forces intrude into our encampment? The Imam told him that he himself would take the baby towards the enemy forces in order to seal his argumentation with them by requesting a few drops of water for the infants, but they will target Ali Asghar's throat with an arrow. As we said earlier, let us say a few words about Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him, and his loyalty to Islam and the Imam. He was approached by Shamr, a commander of the enemy forces, who talked to him about the so-called ties of kinship with him through his mother, Ummul Banin. Shamr said that he had procured a letter of amnesty for him from the governor of Kufa, and if he would leave Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and join Yazid's camp, he would be rewarded with riches and posts. The valiant Abbas spurned the offer of Shamr with the utmost disdain, to the chagrin of that servile minion who had sold his soul to the devil for a paltry sum. He told him, O worshipper of Ma'mun, do not think that Abbas will be lured by your tempting offer of power and pelf. If I die in defending my master Hussein, I shall consider myself the luckiest person. O coward, remember that the valiant die but once. Nobody is born to live eternally. By betraying my master, you have betrayed the prophet whose religion you profess to follow. On the day of judgment, you will be doomed to eternal perdition. On the day of Ashura, Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him, achieved martyrdom in trying to fetch water from the river Euphrates. With the water bag filled, he had jumped into the saddle with one thought uppermost in his mind: to get the water to the anxiously waiting children as quickly as possible. Seeing him galloping towards the camp of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the enemy had engaged him in an uneven fight. Though he was thirsty and hungry, he charged on them and scattered them. The mercenaries of Yazid were running like lambs in a fold when charged by a lion. Seeing that a frontal assault on a man so brave was not possible, they had resorted to a barrage of arrows. When arrows were coming from all sides, Abbas had only one thought in his mind: how to protect the water bag than his life. Seeing that Abbas was preoccupied with this thought, one treacherous foe hiding behind the sand dune had rushed out and dealt a blow on his right hand and cut it off. In a flash, Abbas had transferred his sword to his left hand, and the standard he was bearing he had hugged to his chest. Now that the lion of Ali was crippled, the foes had found courage to surround him. A blow from an enemy sword severed his left arm. The odds were now mounting against him. He held the bag with his teeth and protected the flag with his chest pressed on the horse's back. And soon he fell down and achieved immortal martyrdom.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, welcome to today's episode of Youth Station. I am Zainab, and in the studio with me, I am joined by my brother in faith and humanity,
Brother Habib.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Habib.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so very much for being with us. I'm just going to ask it anyway, since we're talking about it. Imam al-Hussein left Medina because there was a lot of pressure on him. They started threatening his life, and then he probably didn't want hell to break loose all over again in Medina.
Of course, in Medina, they
but then it did afterwards anyway, bro.
Let's talk like this. That he, you know, let's talk like the apparent
when
reasons.
When Yazid attacked Medina during the time of Imam al-Sajjad, the atrocities.
What I want to say here is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam knew he was going to get killed.
Yeah.
Person who knows that he's going to get killed, assassined, what does he do? Does he stay? Or like any other Muslim, he goes to the safest place on earth.
But they hunted them that him down.
We're going there.
Too.
That's a musibah. That's the hardships of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Why do we cry? Why do we cry and do majalis? People asking him why. Abdullah ibn Zubayr was one of the people who also left Medina. Because he was gonna
get
assassinated.
Away this madness, yeah.
Yeah, so he also went to Mecca. He also went to Mecca.
Where was Abdullah ibn Umar?
Abdullah ibn Umar kind of, you know, accepted the fact that Yazid is the caliph. That this
he was like, it is what it is.
It is what it is. And he doesn't care. When Imam Hussein alayhi salam reaches Mecca, he remains there for a couple of months.
4 months and five
yes.
days.
Then they try to assassinate him.
Again. In
Imam
the safest
Hussein
place
salam
in the world.
Asked by Muhammad ibn Hanafi, this question that you have in your mind, that the safest place on earth, Muhammad ibn Hanafi says, this is the safest place on earth. Imam Hussein alayhi salam himself states that they kill me outside, shibr, a couple of inches, outside of Mecca, is better than them killing me inside of Mecca.
So Imam al-Hussein,
he knew
they were going to play
they're
dirty.
Gonna kill him, they're going to kill him.
Yeah.
They're going to kill him, but it's the matter of, you know, dragging them away.
It was him
from
respecting the sanctity
exactly,
of Mecca.
Exactly.
He was like, I don't want my
blood. Abdullah
ibn
Zubayr did not respect it.
Yeah, exactly.
Abdullah ibn Zubayr remained inside Mecca
and
forced Yazid to attack Mecca and
Kaaba,
you know,
and
demolish the Kaaba as well. That's a stupid move from Yazid as well.
He revealed himself, didn't he? He exposed himself. For the blasphemous
he was exposed.
He
did drink in front of everyone. He did do this and that in front of everyone. Where do I go now?
He would go Kufa.
Why Kufa?
Invitation.
Exactly.
12,000 letters.
He sent Muslim ibn Aqil to check out the...
But he sent Qais before that even.
Yeah, but he sent Muslim ibn Aqil.
Immediately, yeah.
The big story. He sent them to Kufa to check out what's up, right? He sends them a message. All right, yeah, people are ready for you. Then they betray him.
Yeah.
They betray
oh,
him.
Oh, man. When I think about Muslim, though,
I
that
mean,
helplessness of that
look,
moment.
Look. Hopelessness. You say this word hopelessness. Imagine who Muslim ibn Aqil is.
Exactly.
Muslim ibn Aqil is one of the heads of the Arabs. Ashraf. Respected. Noble.
Nobleman, yeah.
Sitting down. Thirsty. Not knowing what to do.
Betrayed, abandoned. Stabbed in the back, yeah.
And Imam Hussein, knowing Imam Hussein
is
coming, is on the way. He can't send a message. He has to go out. And people are trying to kill him. And they kill him. And they do kill him. And he fought by himself
bravery.
An army. The bravery.
When I think about it, that moment, he was like, this is it. This is what it boils down to.
And then Imam Hussein receives the news a little late, right?
Of Muslim's death.
And where does he try to go? Either Yemen or someplace else. The army of Hur ibn Yazid come and block his way. And Dhul Hasim or Dhul Jasim or Dhul Chasim. It's a different, they're different.
Because for those who are familiar with Arabic, right? The dots, if they're moved, the letter changes.
Changes, the meaning changes as well. But it's available between Mecca and Kufa. It's closer to Kufa, a couple of miles away from Kufa. They come and they try to take, Hur tries to take Imam Hussein as a prisoner to
Hur.
He tries to bring him back to Kufa. He tries to take him to Kufa as a prisoner to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. And Imam Hussein does not accept. He tries to move this way, that way. He tries to go to change the path to go to Yemen until they reach Karbala.
Exactly. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did all of that. He was stalling because he really didn't want his blood on these people's hands.
Yes.
He's like, Rahmatullah al-Wasa. He's the vast mercy of Allah.
He does not start the
war.
They were not set to kill. The army of
Hur. Just to apprehend him.
Yes. And Imam Hussein knew. And that is why the only weapon that they used was the whip.
Mm.
Both of them used whips on each other.
So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam came this far. You can analyze it however you want, from whatever angle, based on whatever ideology and inclination you have, right? Because there are like Orientalists, historians, they look at it and they're like, oh, Hussein's movement was like a political crusade, right? It was a fight between powers and he wanted to make a statement and he wasn't so successful and he died, right? But, and then there are those who... these are like the Orientalists, like far Western people that are just studying Asian history and culture, right?
The horse of Imam Hussein, as we believe, right? Shias believe, in Kamil al-Ziyarat, it's available, that the horse, when he saw the killing of Imam Hussein, hamhama, he made that sound that horses usually make.
Nee, yeah.
The translation of it was, al-zalima, al-zalima min ummatan qatalat ibn binti nabiyya.
Meaning?
Oppression, oppression, triante, triante. These people have killed the son of the daughter of the Prophet. So it's talking about, there's this zalima, there's this oppression about it.
The fact, yeah, the oppression.
Imam Hussein
factor.
Was oppressed. He exited Medina oppressed. He exited Mecca oppressed. He was taken to Karbala as a prisoner oppressed.
Yeah, but mostly the thing about it is that he was oppressed because he was the justice.
Like he was the solution to all the Islamic problems.
I mean, the point is not to say that, oh my God, I am Imam al-Hussein, everyone cry for me, I'm so oppressed. What the statement that he was trying to make is that I was the truth, the absolute truth, infinite truth.
True.
And they were so bothered by this truth that they slaughtered it in cold blood.
Yes.
This is the statement I'm trying to make. Don't let this happen again. Guess what? It keeps happening anyway.
Pretty much the lesson that we should take is to follow the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave our desires alone.
It's so hard,
look,
though.
It's so, exactly.
But then hurt happens and you're like, there's hope.
Yeah. See, we didn't have the throne underneath our hands. We're not even close to a throne.
And hurt was like, he was hella big deal. He was a general.
Harr ibn al-Riyah came, not only did he come to Imam Hussein, he got on his foot.
Yeah, he got down
on
his
knees. Begging Imam Hussein to forgive him.
And Imam al-Hussein accepted him so graciously, as if nothing had happened. Hurr, we're cool, man. Come on, bro. You know, and
he's the one that imprisoned him to Karbala.
Exactly. He was the one who caused all of this, per se.
Yeah, the last part, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like they sent Hur because they knew Hur could get it done.
He was
a big shot. He was a general. People respected him. People bowed for him. He was from Banu Asad. Yeah. He was a big deal. And then he has a change of heart.
Yes.
Within one night. He's like, what the hell are you doing, bro? How to put yourself together? This is the son of Fatima. And then on the other hand, you have Umar bin Sa'd, which was Imam al-Hussein's playmate. And you're like, I am so confusion.
There's also this man that was available.
How can this happen? It's so scary. If we don't study it enough.
There was also this story. I don't know if you've heard it or not before. A man was was fighting with Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala.
Alongside him?
Alongside him. The name ran away from my mind right now. He was fighting with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Then when he saw that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was going to lose.
He was like, what's the point? You're
all going
to die anyway.
I came to you and I pledged allegiance to you that if you won, if you were successful, or if you had enough army, that I will fight with you.
I would serve you.
But now you don't have nothing.
Mm. I'm going to die anyway.
Goodbye.
You're going to die anyway. What's the point of me?
Goodbye. And he goes away.
Scary, bro.
He goes away.
It's scary.
And the complete opposite where two people, two brothers, young brothers, standing against the enemies, Imam Hussein alayhi salam's last breath, on his last breath, they ask themselves a simple question. Isn't this the son of Fatima?
He's going to die and we're going to remain alive?
Yeah, why are we fighting him? Aren't we Muslims? So they turn their back and defend.
everything about Muharram, everything about
there's
Ashura.
There's also Hamham. I have to talk about Hamham.
Who?
Hamham. He comes late. He reaches where the...
Everything was said and
the
done.
Smoke was available from the tents and everything. He comes and he says, what happened? To the army. He came to the opposite side. He says, what happened? He said, قتل الحسين. He takes out his sword and starts fighting. They say, stop, what are you doing?
He's dead.
Everything is over. He says, who's going to defend this woman? Who's going to defend this woman?
That's exactly it, isn't it? When it's the truth, it doesn't matter when you reach it.
The truth doesn't die. The light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not go off.
Exactly, that's the thing. That's what Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was trying to do. He was trying to set this universal example,
right? It was Imam al-Hafhaf, I forgot the name. Imam al-Zayn al-Abidin alayhi salam calls him one of the bravest men he knew. Imagine yourself, at least 10,000.
One person against this whole 10,000
people
army.
In the middle of their army. Yeah, in the middle of their army. They've just killed...
The most precious person on earth.
Yes, and they're ready to kill anyone.
Anyone else.
And you take out your sword and you defend.
Yeah, exactly. That's the truth. The truth, what Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was trying to say to us is that when it comes to the truth, it doesn't matter when you reach, you defend it. You stand up. Because a lot of people, I feel that, and God, subhanallah, subhanalladhi khalaq al-Husayn. Every aspect of Ashura, every action, every behavior, every conduct, every single word that was delivered by Imam al-Husayn and his companions is a life lesson. Life lesson for every aspect of your life. Because I know a lot of people feel like, oh, I've lived a life of sin. It's too late for me. And then Imam al-Husayn sends you someone like Hur, sends you like someone like this gentleman that you talked about. He reached when everyone was killed, but he was like, well, I got to do something. Right?
Yeah.
It just comes to prove that it's never too late. Imam al-Husayn, he paved the way for generations until the end of time to be able to find their way back to God again with what he did. That's what he did. That's what he did when he left Medina and he left Mecca and he was like, oh, fine, we'll go to Karbala. And you know, so everyone could find their way back home. That blazing beacon of guidance and that ark of salvation when you're gasping for air in the depths of a stormy, wild, ruthless sea and all the waves are doing are beating you down and you feel like that's it. I don't have any strength to fight these temptations, to fight the peer pressure, to fight the influence, to fight my nafs, to fight the sins. Imam al-Husayn comes along and tells you, yeah, it's time to save you now. There's so much more we can talk about the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, but we're out of time.
Unfortunately, out of time.
Unfortunately.
So we took this message from Imam Husayn alayhi salam that he is the truth and they are the guardians of Islam and the true religion and reality. It saves us on the Day of Judgment. And we should get closer to him during these times. And that is
Inshallah.
Why we have these various reports.
Morning sessions, yeah.
Morning sessions, various reports about the blessings of crying for Imam Husayn.
Because it revives something in the heart.
Yes.
Guys, don't underestimate it. Don't underestimate it. Don't forsake it. Don't take it for granted. No matter how tired, how busy you are, even if you can just spare 15 minutes a day to commemorate Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and declare your love to him in one form or another, do it because it's going to seal your salvation in this world and the next. And you don't want to miss out on that. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of Youth Station. Until another greeting, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces killed a 5-year-old girl and at least several other Palestinians on Friday, August 5th, in their latest bombardment of the Gaza Strip, an occupied and deeply impoverished territory that the Israeli regime has been strangling for decades. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading 5-year-old girl among those killed in latest Zionist regime bombing of Gaza. Here's more. The Zionist regime forces killed a 5-year-old girl and at least 7 other Palestinians on Friday, August 5th, in their latest bombardment of the Gaza Strip, an occupied and deeply impoverished territory that the Israeli regime has been strangling for decades. Citing Palestinian officials, the Associated Press reported that Israel unleashed a wave of airstrikes in Gaza on Friday, killing at least 8 people, including the young girl and a military leader identified as Taysir al-Jabari. At least 40 people were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. The Zionist regime airstrikes reportedly hit a residential building in Gaza. The Israeli regime claimed it carried out the assault to preempt an imminent threat from Palestinians, who vowed retaliation after Israeli regime forces arrested a Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader in the occupied West Bank earlier this week. But observers were quick to cast doubt on that rationale. Despite threats by PIJ, there had been no Palestinian escalation from Gaza and the ceasefire formula in place since the last war in May 2021 had been working. Hugh Lovat, a senior policy fellow and West Asia region analyst at the European Council on Foreign Relations, said recently, referring to the tenuous agreement put in place after the Zionist regime's previous large-scale attack on Gaza, which left hundreds of Palestinians dead and nearly 2,000 wounded. Lovat said of the Zionist regime's new attack, "This is unnecessary, unprovoked, and reckless." Jewish Voice for Peace Action, a grassroots group that opposes the Zionist regime's occupation of Palestinian territories, noted on Twitter that U.S. support for the Israeli regime continues to enable its deadly actions in Gaza. In May 2021, the Biden administration moved to greenlight a $735 million weapons sale to the Israeli regime just days before the regime launched its deadly bombing campaign in densely populated Strip. There are U.S.-funded planes and U.S.-funded bombs killing Palestinians in Gaza, the group wrote recently. Again, it added, even before the first Palestinian military response, the United States, which provides billions of dollars in weapons to the Israeli regime annually, endorsed the Israeli regime attack. "We are monitoring developments in Gaza. We urge all sides for calm. We firmly believe that Israel has the right to protect itself," a spokesperson for the White House National Security Council claimed. U.S.-supplied weapons are habitually used in the Zionist regime attacks against Palestinians. The Israeli regime attacks started shortly after 4 p.m. on Friday, August 5th, when airstrikes in Gaza City assassinated a senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance groups. The Zionist regime published a video of its attack on an apartment building in a dense residential area that killed senior military leader Taysir Mahmoud al-Jabari. The Zionist regime warplanes fired two missiles at the 13-story building, causing damage to the tower as well as nearby homes, according to Al-Mizan, a Gaza-based human rights group. Al-Jabari served on Islamic Jihad Council and was the commander of the northern Gaza region. Salama Muharib Abdullah Al-Abed, 39, was also martyred in the same attack.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. it's now widely believed that the US has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive, large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles. And then six zones, military exercise zones, have been identified surrounding the Taiwan island with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan island for 3 days, just to show, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the U.S. and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the U.S. decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the U.S. formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the U.S. policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the U.S. government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification. But neither do they want independence, because independence would affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as China succeeded now in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The U.S. is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony. The United States says it has killed the Al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed a ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, called it a righteous strike,